I'm sitting at the bar and I feel like having a cigarette. I go to light the cigarette and some of the hairs got into the flame. And all of a sudden I felt this terrible pain and knocked the wig off.
That's Bob Durst and filmmaker Andrew Jarecki in an outtake from Chapter 4 of The Jinx, chatting about the do's and don'ts of smoking with a wig on.
There was not many people there, the bartender, two, three, four guys at the bar. And I looked up and they were looking at me, and I just got off of the bar stool and got the wig and put it back on and got back on the bar stool.
But you were aware that that would have attracted attention.
Oh, it did attract attention. They were immediately looking at me. But, you know, now this guy is wearing this wig and he's put the wig back on and he's got a wig and that's that.
Hi, I'm Zach Stewart-Pontier, one of the filmmakers behind HBO's The Jinx, and welcome to the official Jinx podcast, a show where we take you behind the scenes of Andrew Jarecki's documentary series that became a real-life murder investigation. As we get ready to release part two of The Jinx, April 21st, on Max. Today on the show, we're looking back at Chapter 4, The State of Texas versus Robert Durst.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the defendant, Robert Durst, stands charged by indictment with the offense of murder. The defendant has pleaded not guilty.
The evidence was overwhelming and gruesome. Literally hundreds of crime scene photos of Morris Black's dismembered corpse.
Everything. He gave us every single picture that he took of it.
Andrew and I looked through them for the first time on one of our trips to Galveston. This is a moment that's not in the show, but it's kind of amazing that we captured our first reactions.
He really threw the man into the trash. Yeah.
These photos are intense. For me, it's almost like your brain doesn't want to compute it. Like, you see this picture of an arm and you sort of think, oh, there must be a human being on the other side of that arm. But then you click one photo later and the investigators have flipped over the hand, exposing like a raw bone. I mean, it's just, I've never seen anything like it.
Okay. Imagine that shit.
I have to say, it's extremely disturbing.
And so you could imagine, but preparing to go to trial, the confidence that the prosecution must have felt looking through this mountain of gruesome crime scene photos.
Robert Durst shot and killed Morris Black, dismember him, and throw him away like trash. And that was our focus.
Here's the assistant district attorney at the time, Joel Bennett, arguing the case in court.
Burden of proof is on the state to prove to you beyond a reasonable doubt that Robert Durst intentionally shot and killed Morris Black. Look at these pictures. This is what Mr. Durst did, Morris Black. Cut the skin all the way to the bone, pulled the tissue and muscle back, get to the bone, and saw it off.
It was an uphill battle for Durst's defense team. Here's co-counsel Mike Ramsey.
There were moments where you kind of gagged on what you had gotten yourself into. We've got a guy cut up in 20 different pieces, thrown in a bay, and they're expecting us to win this case.
But the defense team did have one thing on their side, unlimited resources. Here's Chip Lewis, another member of the team.
Justice may not be black and white, but it's green. It's very green.
The defense team knew that the whole world viewed their client as a monster, and they worked hard to present him to the jury as a human being. Here's the lead defense attorney, legendary lawyer Dick DeGaron, addressing the jury.
Bob has feelings. This is his first girlfriend. He's been carrying that picture with him. He had it when he was arrested. That's the pictures of his wedding. He and Kathy, he had him when he was arrested.
From the beginning, DeGaron recognized that Bob was probably going to have to take the stand.
If the defendant doesn't testify, then the question the jury has to answer is whether the state has proved their case. If the defendant does testify, then the question becomes, is that some bitch telling the truth or not?
In his interview with Andrew for part one of The Jinx, Bob talked about the decision to testify in his own murder trial.
They said, you're going to have to testify. You're going to have to do real, real, real good. This will be very, very unpleasant. It's a very difficult case.
Bob and Andrew also discuss whether or not he was an honest witness.
Certainly you've said to me that you did lie to the jury in Galveston in some way, that your lawyer encouraged you to.
And he didn't encourage me to. We went over the oath. And from day one, the oath says, you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Just make sure that the ones at the end tell the truth, nothing but the truth, that you do exactly that. In terms of the whole truth, if you want to leave out something that does not, which makes you look bad if you tell it, but does not turn into an untruth, well, try it.
Bob admits that he may have left things out of his testimony, but there's also evidence that he rehearsed it extensively, recording it into a tape deck and sending it to the people closest to him. Here he is talking about his testimony on that tape to his wife at the time, Deborah Sheraton.
Don't you think it's important for me to know that I sound sincere and I sound like I'm telling the whole truth? And the
you are, you do.
But don't you think it's important for me to know that? It makes me feel more confident?
Yes.
By the time Bob gets into court, he's well-practiced and confident taking the witness stand.
Our first witness, Your Honor, is Bob Durst.
Mr. Durst, would you come forward, please? Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
You may have a seat.
The Garin took Bob through the death of his mother.
How old were you when your mother died?
Seven.
And his marriage to his first wife, Kathy.
You and Kathy, after you met, what did you do? Did you begin dating her?
Began dating her, and we started living together almost immediately.
They even bring up Kathy's disappearance.
So I put her on the train in Westchester to go into the city that evening. It was the last time I ever saw her.
Well, I tell my students that if there's a bad fact, embrace it. I call it my embrace the ugly baby theory. it's your baby. You might as well embrace it. And I think that it also, to use a different analogy, mixing metaphors, you steal the thunder from the prosecution's bad evidence about you. If you get it out there, talk about it. Everybody's got something in their background they're not quite so proud of. And everybody knows that no one's perfect. So why not just let the warts show?
So now they've explained who Bob is, warts and all, and the stage is set to get into what happened with Morris Black. The defense team needs to explain what a millionaire is doing living in a boarding house in Galveston, Texas. And why is he disguised as a deaf-mute woman?
The public relations agency that worked for the Durst organization had been receiving calls from the New York City tabloids that they were going to do a new story about the disappearance of Kathy Durst. He said it was going to be a large story, and that as opposed to a missing person stories like it was when Kathy disappeared in 1982, this time it was going to be a focusing on the husband, me story.
What did you learn about this story and who was pushing it?
Janine Pirro was going to use a new investigation of Robert Durst to further her career.
The defense needed a villain for their story, someone who was chasing Bob, and they decided to make that person Westchester County District Attorney Janine Pirro.
Janine Pirro ran him out of New York. And I say that without fear of contradiction. That's what happened. Bob was driven from New York by a politically ambitious woman who wanted to further her own ambition at Bob Durst's expense.
Chip Lewis, a member of Bob's defense team, admits that this wasn't exactly based on evidence.
We kind of created this mythical character in Jeanine Pirro out of... It was an amalgamation of who she was, what her aspirations were, and what the New York tabloid press was. That was all Jeanine Pirro. As you said, she wasn't in those articles. She wasn't quoted. You got that. But it was very easy for us to make that the enemy, somebody Bob was chasing, somebody who was going to get Bob, irrespective of the facts, and that she was a real, clear, and present danger to Bob that he should have feared.
And
that message played well. The jury, they ate that one up.
It's true. Here's one of the jurors, Joanne Gongora. She clearly bought the whole Pirro story.
Jeanine Pirro was after him. I think that she was really out to get him. And with having the pressure on, he wanted to get away. And, I can't fault him for that.
Okay. So now they've explained why Bob's in Galveston. The next challenge is to deal with this disguise. And so the defense team makes a calculated decision here to lean into the humor of the story.
What do you decide to do?
And I decided that I would disguise myself as a woman.
Andrew brings this up in his interview, and it's one of the lines that's just quintessential Bob.
With the hair here and the hair here, I'm going to be looking sort of like a woman. Or if not just like a woman, close enough. And then since I'm going to be a woman, I've got to be mute because I cannot sound the way I sound.
Instead of risking blowing his cover, Bob says that he walked around with a note that said, "I am mute," and a notebook where he would scribble notes to people. He chooses a name, Dorothy Siner.
How did you choose the name of Dorothy Siner?
I don't know. I started thinking of women I had known, and it just sort of was there.
Had you known Dorothy Siner after high school?
No. I just remembered the name, I guess.
And he gets himself an apartment.
Well, I read the newspaper, and I saw that these places had apartments for rent, and they were having open houses. So I put on my wig, and I got my big fat shirt and cargo jeans, and I wrote my "I am mute" note, and I went to, I guess I just went to two open houses, and this one was the better one.
After he moves in, Bob meets the guy living across the hall, an older man named Morris Black.
And when did you run into Morris?
That first night, on the way out of the building, Morris is there, not that different from your movie. "Turn the light off, it's on my meter. You hear me?" Or whatever he said, and I wrote a note or gave him a note. And he said, it kind of blows people away. Mute, you know, people think disabled.
Eventually, Bob says he befriends his neighbor as his undercover character, Dorothy.
And do you remember the moment when he first...
I stopped wearing the woman's wig, so now I'm coming and going from this old house. So he started seeing me.
Was there ever a moment when he said, "Hey, for the last couple of weeks you've been writing me notes and wearing a wig. Now you're not writing notes."
Well,
you can
speak. Became friendlier as time went on in the following months, he asked about how come you know, we're here, why'd you rent the apartment as Dorothy Siner and like that? And I told him I wanted to disappear and hide. He said, yeah, I did that a long time ago. Didn't say he changed his name or he dressed like a woman or anything. But yeah, when I said I just didn't want to be Robert Durst anymore, he said, yeah, I went through that.
This version of Morris Black that Bob's talking about in his interview with Andrew was a friendly, understanding one. This was not the same Morris Black that Bob and his lawyers described at his trial. Here's defense attorney Mike Ramsey again.
There's an old joke in Texas. They hang horse thieves and let murderers go. That's because they don't have any horses that need stealing. We do have some people that need killing. Part of the defense was a famous "he had it coming" defense, where Morris Black was such a bad guy in so many different ways and so crazy, so touched in so many different ways, that we could prove.
The famous "he had it coming" defense was compelling, says New York Times reporter Charles Bagley.
There was a compelling story about Morris Black being the worst neighbor you could ever imagine. I mean, you know, there was a guy that lived in the house next door that used to sit on the porch and smoke a cigarette. And Morris Black would walk down the street and yell at him for smoking on his porch.
He yelled at the children in the neighborhood. He threatened and frightened the kids. He complained about dogs that bark. He carried a stick and threatened people with it.
But DeGaron says Bob Durst saw the best in Morris, that despite his cantankerousness, Bob was patient with him, and the two of them were friends.
If you stop and think about it, if it weren't such a tragic situation, it would be kind of an amusing one. Morris out in front, like a terrier dog, biting and snapping at various people, and Bob walking behind, generally a little bit toked up, kind of cooling things down. It's an odd couple. It's an odd situation.
An odd situation feels like a little bit of an understatement. But nevertheless, when Bob took the stand, everybody knew that eventually he was going to talk about the murder and dismemberment of his neighbor Morris Black. And the defense had a plan for that, too.
In the state of Texas, you find somebody in your house who's not supposed to be there. There's not much you cannot do to them. Most other states, what you're obligated to do is to call the police, do something else. You're obligated to leave. Texas, you're not obligated to leave. You can handle it more or less as you see fit. Obviously, you're not supposed to kill them.
Bob says you aren't supposed to kill them. But he also says that he came home and found Morris in his apartment, and that Morris pulled a gun. They struggled over it, fell over, and the gun went off, shooting Morris in the face. Bob's lawyers say this was a case of self-defense and accident.
He moved and the two of us fell back like that.
As you hit the ground, and as you, or the floor, and as your elbow hit, what happened?
The gun went off.
And now, Bob says, he had a real problem on his hands.
Morris was shot in the face with my gun in my apartment. And I had rented this apartment disguised as a woman. I just didn't think I would be believed. I kept thinking of alternatives to calling the police.
Bob testifies that he knew he had to get Morris out of his apartment. He just didn't know how.
I was going to roll Morris up in the drop cloth and carry Morris out of the apartment. I started to roll the body up in the drop cloth, and I immediately became aware that there was no way I could lift it, that it was hard enough to roll it. I got this idea that the body rolled up in the drop cloth was that I was going to cut it in half.
Bob goes into excruciating detail.
Morris Black had, there were a bunch of tools in his apartment, several saws and an axe and hammers, and there was blood everywhere.
Did you, during the course of that day, dismember Mr. Morris Black's body?
Yes, sir.
What did you do with the parts of the body?
I put them in garbage bags.
The whole thing culminates with this statement.
I did not kill my best friend. I did dismember him.
But the defense says to the jury, this is not what Bob Durst is being charged with, and they work overtime to separate the act of dismemberment with the death of Morris Black.
They put in front of the jury about 1,000 times, was there anything that Robert Durst could do after finding Morris Black dead to prevent his death or to change the manner in which he died? And they brought up about a zillion examples. Can you unstrike a match? No. Can you unring a bell? No. If somebody's dead, is there anything you can do to prevent him from dying? No.
Here's defense attorney Chip Lewis.
And we'd take a common everyday occurrence of you back into a car in the parking lot. The decisions you make afterwards, whether to flee, whether to leave a note, whether to call the police, none of them change the fact that you accidentally backed into that car. And they, so we'd make them all repeat our refrain. What Bob did after the fact doesn't change the act.
On cross-examination, Kurt Sistrunk, one of the prosecutors, attempts to pick apart Durst's story.
Well, you're still thinking about ways to get away from this killing, weren't you?
No, it was not a killing.
But Bob's kind of unflappable.
And the gun turns and it's just like this? Is this your testimony when it goes on?
No, I can't say that's my testimony. The two of you look like spaghetti is the truth of the matter. Okay.
Mr. Black kind of looked like bloody spaghetti, didn't he?
No, he didn't look like bloody spaghetti.
After weeks of trial and days of deliberation, the verdict is in.
For the verdict of the jury is such, with the jury, find the defendant, Robert Durst, not guilty.
In the video of this moment, you can see Bob lean back with a wave of relief. The other people in the courtroom didn't feel the same way. Judge Susan Criss was surprised.
Sometimes you think, oh my God, I can't believe they came up with this conclusion. And sometimes you think, okay, well, that's not what I would do. It's just, it's part of the job that you take on, and it's the system, and you have to have respect for the system.
This verdict was a big deal.
In Galveston, Texas today, a very high-profile murder trial ended with a verdict that was so surprising the defendant appeared to be caught off guard.
New York City real estate heir is acquitted of murder in Texas. Durst, who cut up body, argued self-defense. That's as close as the New York Times will ever come to literally just making a joke on the front page. That's like the New York Times just going, can you believe this?
People outside the courtroom were shocked. But at the press conference after the verdict, Joanne Gongora, one of the jurors we heard from earlier, explained that the prosecution just never presented an alternative story about what actually happened.
I don't think the prosecutors did a very good job. There just wasn't any proof, direct proof, that Morris Black, if he died due to self-defense or accident, or was he actually murdered, none of us really could say, that he actually did it on purpose. You just couldn't come up with that.
I believe that our district attorney's office was incorrect when they thought that the motive for the murder was to steal Morris Black's identity.
The prosecution alleged that the motive for the murder had been to steal Morris Black's identity. And it's true that Bob did use Morris Black's ID to rent a car when he went on the run, but Detective Cody Kaslas has a different theory. And to start, he doesn't buy that Robert Durst and Morris Black were friends.
It was convenient for him to say, yeah, they were best friends and they were best buds. But I never found one person that ever saw them go anywhere together.
He believes that Bob killed Morris to protect himself.
I believe that Morris found out who he was, and he at some point told him, well, if you don't help Jesse Tree, I'm going to tell New York where you're at. And I believe that's what got him killed.
Jesse Tree is a charitable organization in Galveston that Morris supported.
He found a place on the internet where he could buy reading glasses like you get at Walgreens or something for just a fraction of the cost, and he bought $1,000 worth.
Morris Black worked with Jesse Tree to donate glasses to people in need. He'd read some study about how much it helps people to stay connected to the news. But remember, he's cantankerous.
If he found out that you had money to buy beer or cigarettes, he didn't have a problem repossessing the glasses he just gave you, but that was just Morris.
The way Bob tells it, Morris's difficult personality often got in the way of his philanthropic side.
And he had gotten into some arguments with some of the indigents, and the Jesse Tree people said, we're not going to do this with you anymore.
According to Bob, after that, Morris asked him to go to Jesse Tree in disguise.
He took a pair of my glasses and put tape on them. And I know what it was supposed to do for Morris. It was supposed to see if this organization, quote unquote, really would help someone who was in need, wanted a small amount. I was supposed to ask anything for $50 or something like that.
Bizarrely, Bob says he visited Jesse Tree wearing a pair of glasses with masking tape covering the lenses.
And what about the glasses and the tape? What was that about?
He asked me to do that. He had put tape on his glasses so that he sort of, I don't know if he was hiding or he thought he was in disguise, but he had asked me to put tape on my glasses and go, and I did that. Why would I do this? Because Morris asked me to. Why not? I'm not doing anything else in Galveston. I'm only going to do it for a few minutes.
But Detective Cody Kaslas doesn't believe this version of events.
I think his motive was Morris was pressuring him to buy that building for Jesse Tree Charities, and we know that he went in disguise and checked out Jesse Tree.
He thinks Bob put on his eyeglass disguise to figure out how much Morris had told the people at Jesse Tree about who he was. There's evidence that Morris Black had figured out he was living across the hall from Robert Durst.
Morris would go to the library every day. He'd go to the public library, which was just about two blocks from his house, three blocks from his house, and he would use the internet for free.
And guess who else went to the library every day?
I went online every morning at the Rosenberg Library and would look up the New York Westchester newspaper, whatever they call the thing now, and put my name into it and see if there was anything from Jeanine Pirro. And there was frequently stuff, but it never went anywhere.
It's not a stretch to think Morris might have stumbled upon Bob's real identity at one of those library computers.
I think Morris found out who he was because Morris loved to go to the library and get on the internet. There was evidence that Morris wanted Durst to fund Jesse's Tree buying another building. They had outgrown the building where they're located. Morris had told the supervisor, the head over Jesse's Tree, that he knew a man that would either finance the purchase of the secondary building or just buy it outright, because this guy had a lot of money.
For Cody, Bob's motive is not identity theft, but self-protection.
I believe if you do anything to jeopardize his freedom, your life is in danger. I believe that's what happened to Susan Berman. I believe that's what happened to Morris.
In this version of the story, Bob doesn't find Morris in his apartment accidentally. He lures him there to get rid of him.
I think he shoved Morris down and he shot him in the back of the head. And can I prove that? No. Not without the head.
Remember, Morris Black's head was never found. But what was found, among the garbage bags full of body parts, were a few empty bags, with one big slice in each of them. Investigators speculated that once Bob realized the bags were floating and were going to be discovered, he snuck back to the bay, cut the bags, grabbed Morris Black's head, put it into a bowling bag, and disposed of it somewhere along the way to New Orleans. Next time on the Jinx podcast, Chapter 5, Family Values. That's the episode where we discover the envelope with that famous misspelling.
He showed me a letter from Bob to Susan that was from March before she was murdered. The address written on the front is exactly like the cadaver note, down to the misspelling of Beverly.
That's next time on the official Jinx podcast. The official Jinx podcast is hosted by me, Zach Stewart Pontier. It's produced by ZSP Media and Hit the Ground Running Films with HBO. Watch episodes of The Jinx and stream The Jinx Part 2 starting April 21st on Max. This episode was produced by Laura Newcomb. The rest of our team is Ethan Oberman, Naomi Bronner, and Ramoy Phillip. The supervising producer is Liz Stiles. This episode was edited by Simone Polanin. Mixing and engineering by Sam Baer. It was recorded at the Relic Room in New York City. Music by Wes David Thordson. Additional music courtesy of HBO. The executive producers are Andrew Jarecki and me, Zach Stewart-Pontier. Special thanks to Michael Gluckstadt, Ali Cohen, Aaron Kelly, and Savon Slater at HBO Podcasts, and the fabulous Jinx team. Sam Neve, Kyle Martin, Susan Lazarus, Annabelle White, Pedro Vital, Jesse Herman, Michele Zabarfian, Nako Narder, Charlotte Kaufman, and Richard Henkin. And thanks to Roe Dillon, George Vogel, Charlie Wessler, Nancy Jarecki, and Emily Wiedemann. And you, thank you so much for listening. And making it all the way through the credits. Here's Judge Chris talking about the time she ran into Bob at the Galleria Mall in Houston.
So I'm walking down the mall, and I see this man and walking in front of me towards me, and he's talking on the phone, on a cell phone, kind of had his head down. And my first thought was, God, I know that guy. And then it dawned on me, oh my God, that's Robert Durst. And when he saw me and realized who I was, he dropped his phone on the ground and the battery fell out. And so we're standing there just inches from each other. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I can't believe this. And I said, well, hello, Bob, how you doing? And he says, oh my God, I can't believe you're talking to me. I can't believe you're talking to me. Why, you're talking to me. I said, well, you know, Bob, this is what I do. This is my job. This is not personal. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I need to exit from this little encounter, but I'm kind of in my mind trying to figure out, how do I get out of this? This is just a bizarre circumstance. So I said, well, okay, I got to go. You know, have a happy holiday. And I started to walk away, and I thought, oh, God, I wanted to turn back and look, and thought, no, I just need to keep going. And after I got around the corner, I started calling, you know, my mom and my friends and people at work, oh, my God, you're not going to believe who I just ran into.